Hello and welcome to the Martian Drive-In Podcast number 7. My name is Terry Frost and this time around I am going to be talking about a Cronenberg film, David Cronenberg's Existenz, and I knew I'd get that wrong, from 1999. And I'm also going to be going over a bunch of British science fiction TV series that you might not have picked up on, that you might find a bit groovy. They're old, they're retro, and they're very, very good.
The Martian Driving Podcast is a four-weekly podcast of speculative fiction movie appreciation. Each 4 weeks, Terry and his guests will pick two movies and strip them to the bone. They can be new, old, or in between science fiction, fantasy, or horror. What they have in common is that they aren't the big blockbusters that everyone knows about. Martian Drive-In looks for the interesting films that might not be on your radar, but that might just be worth your attention and appreciation. Go to marsdrivein.blogspot.com. Feedback is always welcome via email at cultguru@gmail.com. That's K-U-L-T-G-U-R-U at gmail.com. Or you can leave a voicemail at area code 206-2033-299. Enjoy!
And I'm back. I haven't been able to get a guest this time. I did have someone in mind, but they weren't able to assist. But I will have a guest for the next Martian Drive-In podcast, which will be number 8. So I decided to wing it again and do this solo. So how has everybody been? Things here have been interesting in the Oriental sense. There are some illnesses in the family, particularly Sal's father. So even though Peter doesn't listen to this, I'm sending a shout out, wishing him well and hope he gets better soon. And that's kind of taken up the emotional oxygen a little bit over the past couple of weeks. So I haven't been doing too much interesting stuff. And if I'm a little bit down key on this episode, I do apologize for that. I did see some films, though, surprisingly enough. How about that? I saw some films. I did that. I'll tell you what I did on the radio over the last couple of weeks, which was a lot of fun. First thing I did was Ivor and I, for the ABC local radio Northern Territory / Darwin gig, did Blue Velvet, the wonderful David Lynch film. So we had a lot of fun with that. We couldn't put in any sound clips of Dennis Hopper from that film because he said fucking just about every line he said in that film. But apart from that, we talked about the themes, we talked about the actors in it, and had a lot of fun with the dark and nightmarish world of David Lynch. So I really enjoyed taking the radio gig in a slightly different direction doing that. A lot of fun. Really should podcast on Paleo Cinema, maybe Blue Velvet at some stage with a guest, and we can kind of paradiddle around that for a little bit. But we did that. Now, the most recent one we did on Friday night was The Princess Bride, so I thought I'd kind of change key from the David Lynch. So Ivor and I talked The Princess Bride. We did a lot of Inigo Montoya's kind of stuff and had a lot of groovy fun with that. We talked about Peter Falk as the best grandfather ever in the frame story in The Princess Bride and all of the other stuff. We talked about Christopher Guest channeling Henry Daniell in The Seahawk in his role as Count Rugen, all those kind of things. There was just a richness to what we could talk about for that one that we did waffle a little bit over time, and he's going to have to edit it down a little bit, but it was good fun. Next one we're doing, I've decided to kind of step right out of the usual format. We're going to do the Daniel Craig Casino Royale. Skyfall's coming up next month. Really looking forward to that. I've got my fanboy squee happening for that film. And so we thought we'd have a look at the total retcon that Daniel Craig's James Bond is. So next week we're going to be recording that, and I'm going to wear a tuxedo in the studio. No, I'm not. But one way or the other, we're going to have a lot of fun doing that and then just grooving on that. Now, as far as genre films are concerned, I saw Prometheus, and isn't that fucking ordinary? Now, I know there are a lot of people who like Prometheus, and there are a lot of people who are very much defenders of Ridley Scott's work, but apart from the special effects, which were extraordinary, and the acting, which was pretty top chop, basically, there was nothing there that was in any way spectacularly new or different or wonderful or marvelous. It was, you know, go to an alien planet. It was like Journey to the Seventh Planet done on a 2012 budget. There's nothing new there. Nothing extraordinary, nothing spectacular. Human race created by a bunch of bald muscle men. What the fuck is pretty much my reaction to it. I'll probably get a copy of it at some stage when the price comes down on Blu-ray, just to fill out the Blu-ray science fiction collection. But I was underwhelmed. Now, if you disagree, please, you know, drop me a line, drop me a voicemail. You can do it directly at marsdriving.blogspot.com by clicking the little voicemail linky at the side of that, if you like. Or you can send a voicemail to cultguru@gmail.com or to the phone number. But underwhelmed by Prometheus. Really, really underwhelmed. I think Ridley Scott's a good visualist, but I'm not sure he's a good science fiction filmmaker. In spite of Blade Runner, of course, and in spite of Alien. Alien basically was a haunted house movie set in a spaceship. What we're looking for, particularly with Martian driving kind of films, is the stuff that have really rock-solid ideas and speculations in them. And I don't think anything Ridley Scott's done has really fulfilled those criteria. So having said that, and probably pissed off a bit of my audience, which is what I'm here for, we'll go on to take a look at the mise and see if there are any other genre films that I've taken a look at recently that I can't off the top of my head recall. I've only just had my espresso of the day and it hasn't quite kicked in yet, so bear with me on that. Let's see what we've got. What have I watched? Blah, 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 blah. I did see The Empire of the Ants, which has Joan Collins getting eaten by ants and Robert Lansing. Low-budget ant film from the 1970s. It was fun revisiting that. I hadn't seen it since I saw it in the cinema back when Jesus was playing Cowboys. And, it's a little bit of fun. Nothing particularly wonderful, but, you know, giant ants. And they kind of stayed true to their premise. It was one of those films where you kind of wish they had CGI because if they had CGI for the ants, it would have worked really better. It works better, and I think that this kind of film really is your template for those sci-fi channel movies that we see every week these days. The template is films like Empire of the Ants and all the films that came before that, all those kind of giant animal things where you get a weird and quirky group of people trying to save the world on a very small budget and a very low, very small scale, and for that you've got to kind of honor it. It's not, yeah, fantastically great film, but it's entertaining, and that's always sometimes very hard to do, but it's often incredibly worthwhile doing. So having said all that, I'm going to get on with the news from the planet Mars, and there is a little bit. I actually got some from the planet Mercury as well, so groovy stuff.
Here is the breaking news from the planet Mars.
Okay, we'll go to the Mercury stuff first, because that's the silliest, probably. Though both of the news items I have are quite silly. Apparently, somebody has found a series of three craters on Mercury. Well, a NASA probe has. That look like the Cookie Monster from Sesame Street. Now, this, is very topical because Mitt Romney wants to get rid of Sesame Street, so the Cookie Monster is endangered at the moment. And in a very timely thing, NASA has found big crater with a couple of small craters that look like the eyes of the Cookie Monster. And they've publicized this. Probably some Democrat supporter in NASA has come up with the idea that this series of three craters look like the Cookie Monster. Now, if you type in Mercury Crater Cookie Monster into Google or Bing if you're retarded, basically you will find a copy, a link to the Cookie Monster craters. And I think this is kind of good. One of the things human beings do is they make patterns out of stuff that doesn't have patterns in it, really. That's the reason why those people on those silly shows record really bad audio with really dodgy audio recorders and then play back the static and find the voices of ghosts in it. It's the same kind of thing where we make patterns out of stuff that doesn't have patterns in it. But in this case, of course, it's a lot more benign. So that's the news from Mercury. I've got some news from Canada and Mars, which, of course, there's a natural link between Canada and Mars for no particular reason. And I'll just get the page up for that. There's a village called Glenelg. Actually, it's in Scotland. What was I thinking about Canada? Probably thinking of some latitude in the Northern Hemisphere. I'm going to read this off, he said, independent.ie, which is an Irish newspaper. Residents of Glenelg in the northwest of Scotland hosted a day of events today to mark the journey of the remote-controlled NASA Curiosity rover, which is on its way to Glenelg on the Red Planet. Remember a couple of episodes ago I mentioned that they were going to a place called Glenelg on Mars? So this Scottish village decided to have a piss-up based on this fact. The Scottish village, which has a population of around 300 people, attracted crowds of up to 400 at its official twinning ceremony, at which a plaque was unveiled by former NASA astronaut Bonnie Dunbar, declaring Glenelg twinned with Mars. So basically it's a twin city with the whole planet Mars. The Space Stars and Mars celebration featured a range of space-themed events, including a chance to drive a Mars rover around a simulated Mars landscape in the school hall, a Cayley and stargazing event. So, you know, this is good. Little village in Scotland decides to, you know, use this for a bit of a piss-up and a bit of fun. And they've done it, and more strength to them as well. It's probably good for the kids in the local village too, because they're going to take an interest in science, which I'm big in favour of. I really think that the world's not going to progress if we don't get more scientists, and one of the ways that we do that is to engage children. And I don't care whether it's watching Star Trek, the old series in the 1960s, or how kids get that kind of an interest. I really like the fact that they do. And they got enormous crowds to it and had a great time with it as well. So more strength to them. Let me just see what I've got. And there's another thing too, another bit of Mars news, which I just found in a bit of a pop-up. There was a small pit created when Curiosity dug out a bit of Martian soil. And one of the weird things is they found something bright and shiny at the bottom of this little trench that they dug. It's really weird, but I've got the picture up here, and they've got all the kind of gravelly little round bits of dirt from Mars, and it looks incredibly terrestrial too. But they're going to use X-rays to determine the composition of it, but they dug up something shiny, kind of like when you dig in your back garden and you find an old jam tin lid or something unexpected down there. They're not sure what it is, but they're going to... a couple of weeks ago, they found another shiny object on Mars, but it was actually a bit of plastic that came loose from the rover itself. But in this case, they're pretty sure that's not it. So we've got another mystery here. What's the bright, shiny thing that Curiosity found in a little trench on the planet Mars? And this is the lovely thing about this kind of exploration. The really weird and wonderful stuff that unexpectedly comes up. So I hope Curiosity does a lot more work like this, finding weird stuff. If it finds any ring pulls and things like that, we're going to have a big mystery on our hands. But at the moment, they're searching for bright, shiny objects, and it's all being used for an excuse for a bit of a knees up in a Scottish village. So that's about it for the news from Mars. But there's bound to be more next time around.
There's an intimacy involved in playing existence that is beyond description. They just pop your spine with a little hydro gun.
Break out of your cage, Michael.
I haven't crippled anyone yet. Step into my office.
Now I'm warning you. It's going to be a wild ride.
The new millennium.
This is amazing.
We'll bring a new experience.
You're the power source.
We'll see how natural it feels.
Where the playing field is a parallel universe.
The game's a lot more fun when it starts feeling realer than real. No use fighting.
I don't like it here. I think it's infected.
It's not infected. It's just excited.
I think we're still inside the game.
We have enemies in our own house. I do feel the urge to kill someone here.
Do it. It's just a game.
Something's wrong.
Oh, God.
What happened?
Let's come back here with us.
Don't hurt me, Michael. Play with me.
Existence is a 1999 body horror science fiction film by Canadian director David Cronenberg. It stars Jennifer Jason Leigh, Jude Law, Ian Holm, Dom McKellar, Sarah Polley, Christopher Eccleston, and Willem Dafoe. 1999 was a really big year for virtual reality in film. Of course, virtual reality dates back to the 1980s and was very big in books like Neuromancer and all of the cyberpunk kind of things. Not all of them, but a number of the cyberpunk fictional works kind of had virtual reality as one of the themes in it. But 1999 really in cinema was the big thing. The Matrix came out in 1999 as well as Existence. And another interesting little film called The 13th Floor, which starred Craig Bierko and Gretchen Mol. Basically all of them along the same theme, you know, is reality reality, all that kind of jazz. But Existence is, because of course it's Cronenberg, it's got its own little interesting twists on things. And of course the body horror theme that's gone through Cronenberg's films way back into the 1970s. I think Crimes of the Future, his first science fiction film, came out in 1970, so the guy's been tapping that theme for at least 40 years. So basically, here's a bit of the plot from Wikipedia. In the near future, organic virtual reality game consoles known as game pods have replaced electronic ones. The pods are attached to bioport outlets inserted at the base of the player's spine through umbilical cords. Two game companies, Antenna Research and Cortical Systematics, compete against each other. In addition, a group of realists fight both companies to prevent the deforming of reality. Antenna Research's Allegra Geller, played by Jennifer Jason Leigh, is the greatest game designer in the world. She's testing her latest virtual reality game, Existence, with a focus group and a seminar. And then the shit hits the fan. I won't go any further than that. But the weird thing about the very name Existence, and a couple of the screenwriters were Hungarian, a couple of producers were Hungarian, is that there's a pun in the title Existence. E-X-I-S-T-E-N-Z. Which, of course, is not the normal way to spell existence. The I-S-T-E-M bit in the middle is a Hungarian pun because Isten is the Hungarian word for God. So you've got X, God, Z on the end. So, yeah, how many movies do you know, English language films, have Hungarian puns in them? So, basically, I kind of like this film for a number of reasons. I do like Cronenberg stuff, though some of it you can't watch too often because it is very confronting and intrusive into the body. But this one's a little less so. Videodrome, of course, was body horror as well. The Brood, any number of other films of his. Let's go through some of the body horror ones. Shivers, of course, Rabid, with Marilyn Chambers in it. The Brood, as I said, Scanners. Videodrome, The Dead Zone, of course, The Fly, his remake of The Fly. Dead Ringers in particular, Naked Lunch very much so, Crash, Existence, little less since then. The movies he's done since then, Spider, of course, was about a schizophrenic character played by Ralph Fiennes, History of Violence, Eastern Promises, A Dangerous Method, and Cosmopolis. He's kind of drifted away from the body horror at the point of Existence. And there's probably a good reason why, because I took a look at the box office for Existence, and to be honest with you, it died in the arse. It cost $31 million to make, and it didn't go near to making the money back, so it's not a particularly popular part of Cronenberg's oeuvre. but I think it's kind of interesting, almost historically now, because the kind of science fiction this movie is has kind of been normalized almost since that time in the last 12, 13 years since the movie came out. One of the things that happens with things that are very big in science fiction cinema is that the trope migrates to television as well and becomes very much normalized in our perceptions. And that's the case in this one, though it does have a lot of really groovy Cronenbergian bits and pieces. The game pods themselves are incredibly organic looking. They're kind of rubbery and they've got nipples or clitorises over them, which are the interface to play the game. So you've got this fleshy tit-like mass almost, which you hooks to your base of your spine by an umbilical and a little anus kind of thing they implant at the base of your spine like a second asshole. And when you manipulate the nipples or the clits or whatever the hell they're supposed to be, the game pod rise organically and in a very disturbing way and makes a squishy liquid noise, which is kind of weird and very much a Cronenberg thing. And of course the little nubs that insert into the ports at the base of your spine, of course there's any sort of number of parallels you can make with that. And the two main characters, Allegra Geller, played by Jennifer Jason Leigh, and Ted Pikel, played by Jude Law, he's never had a game pod before, and then they go into an illegal game port implantation place, which is basically a garage run by Willem Dafoe. Now, the last person you want putting extra arsehole at the base of your spine is somebody who looks like Willem Dafoe wearing a pair of overalls. Really, I mean, the grin, the mania, the fact that he's got like zero body fat, it's all very creepy, but the job gets done. And of course, Jude Law gets a second arsehole at the base of his spine. It's a very, very freaky bit, and of course it kind of gets into an area not entirely unlike Gay Panic for the character, Pikel, played by Jude Law. This movie's very hard to judge, too, from the point of view of good or bad acting. Now, there's a reason why. Most of the movie, or at least part of the movie, in fact, it could be all of the movie, takes place in a virtual world. And the people we see on the screen may be real people, or they may be real people playing game characters. And there are these really weird pauses at various times, which at first look might be the people thinking about stuff, but really they could be a computer game buffering to just before the next move is made. And it does. And the lovely thing that Cronenberg does in this is have that in there, that kind of pacing. There's a scene in a very down market and probably none too hygienic Chinese restaurant inside the game world of existence, where that buffering from non-player characters, who turn out to be player characters, we find out, but that buffering really kind of does add an incredible eeriness to what they're doing. And I kind of like that as well. I don't think that the film's entirely successful, but I think it's a nice piece of work. It's a movie that we may have all seen a decade or more ago, and it really is worth revisiting. Now, I'm going to play another clip, which is the bit in the Chinese restaurant with Jennifer Jason Leigh, Jude Law, and a few other people. And it may give you just a little bit of a feel of that buffering kind of stuff that I mentioned before. The other thing to listen very carefully about is that slightly flattened effect to the way people are speaking. They're not speaking the way normal people do, with a lot of emotion. They're speaking almost as if they're in a dream or in another world. So there's that as well. Now, to set up this scene, they've been given the special of the day, which has got a whole bunch of really gooby, bony, gelatinous, meaty-covered chunks of stuff on a bed of garnish to eat. Now, Ted Pikel's character, the Jude Law character, playing the game character, grabs bits and pieces of this bony yucky muck, eats the flesh off them, and then assembles a bone gun out of the bits and pieces of bone left over. Then he takes out his a prosthesis in his mouth, like a fake set of false teeth, and puts them in the back of the gun. And what the gun's going to do is shoot his teeth as bullets. So I'll just play that now and give you a little bit of the feel of that otherworldliness that comes in the game world of existence.
I do feel the urge to kill someone here.
Who?
I need to kill our waiter.
Oh. Well, that makes sense. Waiter! Waiter! When he comes over, do it. Don't hesitate. But
everything in the game is so realistic. I don't think I really could.
You won't be able to stop yourself. You might as well enjoy it.
Free will is obviously not a big factor in this little world of ours.
It's like real life. There's just enough to make it interesting.
He's too nice. I won't do it.
What can I do to make your lunch more pleasant?
I found this in my soup, and I'm very upset.
This movie has the singularly ugliest guns known to the universe, and also one of the most disturbing mobile phones. Jude Law has a thing called a pink phone, which is kind of pink and fleshy and looks like it would not be out of place in an adult shop. And which, of course, is the intention of Cronenberg in this film, to really kind of merge sexuality and sensuality with game geek culture in a really weird way. And the weird thing you notice too, which again is in this own way very disturbing, Allegra Geller, the Jennifer Jason Leigh character, treats her game pod as a pet almost, as if it's a member of a family or a very close friend. When things start going wrong with her game pod, she is as genuinely disturbed as somebody will be when a very close family pet becomes ill or gets damaged in some way. There's a real emotional connection the character makes with what's essentially an Xbox, which again is kind of weird. But given the intimacy of the interface between the gamer and their machine, you can kind of understand why and how that kind of emotional connection comes about. It really does take the idea of computer gaming and of gaming and, of course, of virtual worlds into another area. And I really do like that. I love the fact that they've thought it through and Cronenberg's realized that computer games are a big thing and merged it into the tropes that he has in his own movies. Yeah, really, it's an interesting... I don't think it's a particularly successful film in a lot of ways, but it is a very interesting one, and it taps into something which has been investigated seriously by a number of scientists to this day. There is a kind of thing at the moment where scientists are investigating the possibility that their entire universe is a computer simulation, and there's recently, in the last few days, been some bits and pieces of investigation which have hinted that there are certain aspects to the fine structure of the universe which are not inconsistent with the universe being a computer simulation. It's not saying, I mean, it's very hard to prove that you're in a game when you're in a game, in a sense. But they're kind of looking for indirect evidence of, is the universe we know somebody's version of The Sims, in a sense. Now, I'm not sure if we can ever prove that definitive, definitively. My mouth is going a bit dry at the moment. But one way or the other, whether we can prove it one way or the other. But if we were able to prove that the universe is a simulation, what does that say? What does that do to theology? What does that do to physics as we know it? What does that do to our sense of self? And what does that do to the way people will act if there were ever sufficient proof that we're basically just software, in a sense, and that everything we know and everything we can know is just software? I hope it isn't. I hope that we do have something like free will. I'd really hate for myself and everybody I know to be fucked up by a patch upgrade of an operating system or of a game playing system in some ways. I know that when Sal upgrades her sims, there's usually something that goes catastrophically wrong somewhere in the process. So I hope that if we are a simulation, the people running it really do have a whole bunch of beta checkers working out the bugs in the upgrades before they're applied to the game. But as I said, Cronenberg's films are always interesting. Haven't seen much. I haven't seen Eastern Promises yet. I haven't seen Cosmopolis, and I haven't seen An End of Violence yet. But I'm really going to kind of have to tap into those soon and have a bit of fun with them. But his earlier stuff I'm watching at the moment, I'm just started watching Rabbit, re-watching Rabbit. That came out years and years ago on VHS in Australia and was very popular at the time. But not too much else to say about Existence. It's because the technology's changed a bit since that time, it's almost become historical science fiction speculation, in a sense. Nobody does virtual reality anymore. We're deep into zombie apocalypses, dystopias, and fucking up the human race in the way that contemporary science fiction approaches these, approaches itself. So virtual reality, I mean, it'll probably make a comeback in 20 years' time. Somebody will rediscover it and retcon the idea of virtual reality and play around with that a little bit more. But at this stage, it's just not happening. So that's about it for Existence. I'm going to take a break now. When I come back, I'm going to tap you into a few older British science fiction TV series, not the obvious ones, but just kind of have a little bit of a talk around why I like them and why I think that they're important to know about and maybe a bit groovy to watch as well.
Hammer Film Productions began in 1934, and after producing almost 200 films and television programs, the studio is still releasing and re-releasing new and classic film titles. 1951 Down Place is the podcast that brings you the story of the great Hammer films, one movie at a time. Here are your hosts, describing what Hammer means to them. First is Casey.
Hammer means the beautiful and glamorous women of Hammer horror, the engaging storytelling, and amazing period films.
Joining him is Derek.
Hammer means the incredible work of actors like Peter Cushing, Christopher Lee, and even Michael Ripper. The gothic storytelling, the incredible music, and the set pieces.
And finally, here's Scott.
Hammer, wasn't that an 80s cop show on ABC with David Raich?
This boy has a lot to learn. Join our hosts as they make their journey through the Hammer Films catalogue and discuss each film with critical opinion, historical facts, production notes, and other information about these classic films. 1951 Down Place can be found in iTunes or their website, www.1951downplace.com.
Wait, that was Sledgehammer.
1951 Down Place, the home of Hammer Films discussion.
Okay, now we're on the subject of British television science fiction. The Brits have been doing television science fiction for, and I shit you not, 74 years. They've been doing it since 1938. Back in 1938, 2 years after television started in England, there was a bit of a hiatus during the war, 39 to 45, 46. They didn't have any television. But right at the start, they had a 405-line TV service from November 1936. The shows weren't very good. They recycled British movie tone newsreels and music hall acts, and basically it was pretty shit. But in 1938, February 11th, they did a adaptation of RUR, the Carol Čapek play, Rostrum's Universal Robots, which was kind of, look it up, it's Artificial People. Really old play, dates back to the 1920s. One of the first gigs Spencer Tracy had as an actor was playing a robot in a stage adaptation of RUR. So they've been doing it for a very long time. And so I thought one of the things I wanted to do with Martian Drive-In podcast is kind of look at that kind of stuff as well, the forgotten and the groovy British, and of course American, but America's been churned over a lot more people know about even the bad old American science fiction TV shows. In fact, some people love them and other people remake them. But the British ones kind of do have, even though this one was sort of remade in 1999, the first one I'm going to talk about, they really don't get too much love, and I just thought I'd give them a little bit of love, because I'm the love god when it comes to these things. But anyway, this one I'm talking about first is Doomwatch from 1970. Really interesting little show, somewhat forgotten now. In 1999, there was a sequel remake-y kind of thingy called Winter's Angel, done as a one-off. But I'll just talk about what Doomwatch was and why I think it's worthy of your consideration. Doomwatch ran from 1970 to 1972. It ran 38 episodes. It was created by two guys called Jerry Davis and Kid Pedler. Jerry Davis was kind of a script editor on Doctor Who in the 60s. And Kid Pedler was kind of the unofficial science advisor. He was a scientist. So the Doomwatch story, basically, Doomwatch is the organization run by a number of scientists. The official name of the organization is the Department for the Observation and Measurement of Scientific Work. Basically, I'm paraphrasing here from Wikipedia, by the way. This isn't off the top of my head. Doomwatch is an agency dedicated to preserving the world from the dangers of unprincipled scientific research. And here's a quote from Dr. Spencer Quist, who's one of the characters on there. We were set up to investigate any scientific research, public or private, which could possibly be harmful to man. By that they mean humanity. It's kind of like a fringe division for the 1970s, way ahead of its time, and of course fringe may well have been influenced indirectly or directly from the Doomwatch series. And the kind of things they tackled were very much in that kind of fringy area. The first episode, The Plastic Eaters, was about a man-made virus which eats plastic. There was an episode where children in a certain place are getting attacked by a colony of super intelligent rats. There's even an episode which is really groovy where free chocolates are being handed out on the street, and a group of young girls get them, and it turns out that what the chocolates have in them is a drug which makes you very susceptible to subliminal advertising, and the chocolates are actually being sold and given away by a tobacco company which wants to keep people smoking. So it's really interesting the way that works, and yeah, they address subliminal advertising, they address the problem with nuclear power, they address the problem with toxic waste, very environmental kind of concerns, and very topical concerns too. So it's kind of science fiction based on real world concerns, which is kind of cool. They did have a real problem at the end of the first series, and there were three series of Doomwatch. Robert Powell, the actor who played Jesus of Nazareth and did a number of other things, including a remake of The 39 Steps, was one of the most popular characters on there, a guy called Toby Wren. At the end of the last episode of the first series of Doomwatch, and don't worry, it's not a spoiler because they've lost the episode, Toby Wren gets blown up by an explosive device. And this is one of the first times in kind of television where a really popular character was killed off because the actor wanted to go away and do other things. And there were great protests. The BBC got more letters about that particular incident than they had about anything since World War II, which goes to show you that the show was incredibly popular, and of course Robert Powell was a very popular actor at the time. So I'll just play a little bit of a grab from an episode of Doomwatch just to give you a little bit of a feel of where it's coming from. The good news before I do that is if you go to YouTube, there are a few episodes on YouTube. So you can download a few of the episodes. You can't get the whole lot. I believe there may have been a DVD release. Some of the episodes are lost, as many things are from that particular time. The BBC at the time wasn't particularly careful about retaining their stuff. In fact, there was a great big purge in the either the late 60s or the early 70s, where all of the videotapes and film of some very early TV got chucked out by the BBC because it wasn't considered cost-effective to store them anymore. So they wiped over tapes, they destroyed film, they basically razed their heritage, which now many millions of dollars worth of stuff was basically chucked away because they couldn't be bothered keeping it. Some anal retentive bureaucrats just destroyed it, which is incredible. But I'll play the bit from Doomwatch just to give you that feel about it now.
Can we come to the police attempt to clear the pier? The superintendent requested you to leave.
He ordered me to leave. I refused.
Would you like to go on?
Thank you. I ordered the superintendent to leave the pier.
What authority?
None.
You mean you deliberately defied Air Commodore Parks and the police in the execution of their duties?
Yes.
Would you like to tell the tribunal why?
Thank you. I believe conventional explosion to be certain, nuclear explosion to be possible.
Upon what evidence?
The weapon had been tampered with and digital countdown commenced. My estimate at that time was 25 minutes to the trigger mechanism being activated.
25 minutes that should have been better employed in clearing the pier, as ordered.
I dispute that. Had you cleared the pier, the result would have been damage to property only, worth at most £2,000. Or nuclear explosion. Not possible. You, Dr. Warren, are a very important physicist.
Thank you.
And are you saying that the fault locks always fail safe?
In this case, yes.
Your evidence, please.
We recovered the dismantled parts.
The parts dismantled by Mr. Wren?
Yes, we know from these that nuclear fission could not have taken place.
But this evidence, of course, is hindsight. This evidence would not be available before the dismantling.
It's irrelevant, surely. These weapons are not assembled by boys extending their Meccano sets.
Well, presumably designed by optimists. Now, it is proved that damage had caused radiation leakage.
Yes.
And this is apparent in the recovered parts?
Yes.
Now, had these parts not been jettisoned into the sea by Mr. Wren, would not the conventional explosion have irradiated the area?
A safe dose. A safe dose dissipated at sea.
At sea? I should have called it offshore.
The explosion occurred at the end of the pier. It was a minor explosion.
How would you define a safe dose?
It's accepted by Nelson.
What is? Are you familiar with the work of Dr. Alan Moore of Stanford University?
Yes.
Like yourself, a very important physicist. I quote, "We do not know what constitutes a safe dose. Little or no research has been done in this area. When we do find out, it will already be too late." Would you dispute this?
I differ with some of Dr. Moore's conclusions.
As I differ with some of yours.
Well, that's a clip for a couple of reasons, one of which is they were discussing what is a safe radiation dose back in 1970, something that has now become incredibly important since Chernobyl and Fukushima. And I also like the fact that there's a curmudgeonly scientist talking with another scientist and disagreeing with him. Kind of it has a kind of Quatermass feel. Quatermass being your definitive grumpy scientist in a fictional context. And of course, the Quatermass originally started out as a TV series before Hammer made the movies. But I do like Doomwatch. In fact, I've downloaded a bunch of episodes now and I'm going to gorge on them after I finish podcasting today. And just kind of get that feel for a retro look at the dangers of the future. It's set in the contemporary times, of course, of 1970, but it's all about scientific dangers in the future, and I kind of like that in a fiction format. And it's well, I mean, it doesn't cost you anything to download from YouTube. I don't believe they're available on DVD. If they were, they'd be worth getting. And the other thing, too, is that there was a Doomwatch movie made by Amicus in the early 70s, which carried on with some of the characters, but the main emphasis were a different set of characters, with goings on an island. I don't think it's as good as the TV series, from what I've seen of the series. But if you can find it, it's worth checking out. So, on to another piece of British television science fiction that I find a lot of fun. UFO from 1970. A lot of fun. It's my favourite of the Gerry Anderson science fiction TV series that have been put out. Can't stand Space 1999. I haven't been able to rewatch it recently because it's atrociously stiff and boring and slow and stupid. But UFO I really like. Set in 1980, which is 10 years in the future from when it was filmed in 1970. And to be honest with you, 1980 never looked so good. There were groovy clothes, there were groovy cars, there was a moon base full of women in leotards wearing purple wigs, there were alien invasions, there were groovy vehicles of all kinds, and the head of a movie studio, Ed Straker, was in fact the head of SHADOW, the Supreme Headquarters Alien Defence Organisation, set underneath the movie studio in England. So that was kind of groovy too. But the real plus for UFO as a TV series was the fact that it took its concept seriously and had fantastic special effects. The special effects by Derek Meddings, who went on to, I believe, win an Oscar. I'll just double check that. But Derek Meddings' special effects were beautifully state-of-the-art. The miniatures worked, the explosions, a whole lot of it were really top-of-the-range special effects in that sense. And, of course, continuing on from things like Thunderbirds and Supercar and Fireball XL5, which were all of the fantastic earlier series that Gerry Anderson did. Let me see. He won an Academy Award in 1979, Derek Meddings, for Special Achievement Award, and a few BAFTAs as well. So, all good there. It's a really good series, but as I said, the effects are great, but also they take the concept seriously. There's some very adult and very dark plot lines in episodes of UFO. There's a whole episode dedicated to the earlier disintegration of Ed Straker's marriage because of the secret organization he has, the time he can't spend with family. And it's a good piece of drama, let alone a good piece of science fiction drama in a sense, because, of course, it's set in the future, though it could be anybody in a high-intensity job. The fact that they actually dedicated an episode to that that arc of the character is quite interesting. And the alien invasion is not exactly typical. All the bodies that they find of the aliens are humans, but they've been altered and had additional organs put into them from transplanted from other human beings and things like that. So I won't spoil that for you. The series is available on DVD. In fact, I've got it myself on DVD. And it's just stylish to look at. It's got a bit of grunt as far as the plot lines are concerned, and it's got really good special effects, and of course that you got to like the music on it. The music is fantastic stuff. Let's see, Barry Gray's music. Of course, Barry Gray had worked earlier with Gerry Anderson as well, but I really do like this one. It's worth rewatching it. It does age well. I mean, the technologies have changed. Of course, nobody predicted flat screen TVs and USB ports in 1970, but it's not offensively anachronistic in that sense. You can kind of accept the fact that they were trying to find how the future would be and taking it seriously. The set design and the production design on it is exceptional for the time and really worth checking out. A lot better, in fact, than for something like Space 1999, which was trying to be incredibly futuristic and in that failed. If you have a look at Space 1999's kind of mid and late 1970s futuristic stuff, it just doesn't age as well as in UFO. And there's a large fan base for the series as well, but I really do find it worthwhile. And they had some decent actors in there. Vladik Shabal, who was in From Russia with Love, of course. David Warbeck. A lot of the people in The Gentleman's Guide to Midnight Cinema might know David Warbeck from all the really poor Italian movies he made later in his career. Ed Bishop playing Ed Straker was fantastic. I met him once at a convention briefly. The people who were supposed to take him to dinner didn't take him to dinner, so we got to chat for a little bit. And he's a very polite and gentlemanly fella. Now, he died a few years ago, but I do remember the kind of nice gentleness about the man, which is gives him a lot of respect. Stephen Berkoff was in an episode as well, which is kind of interesting. I'm going to have to rewatch it now just to see the episode with Stephen Berkoff in it. But UFO, really, I love the fact that they took it seriously. I love the fact that they put in the effort as far as every aspect of the production is concerned. And I think in that, it's kind of stands up to scrutiny 42 years later that really, this was a quality show, and it's incredibly watchable too. It's one of those ones where you put the disc in and you end up watching five episodes and go, oh shit, I've spent a lot of time watching this. So UFO, definitely worth doing and definitely worth consideration. Now, I'm not going to do any more TV shows this time around. I want to do more research on it. This was a bit thrown together, as you may guess from the way I'm talking about it, but I do want to throw in a few more TV series that are available and that people might have an interest in into future Martian Driving podcast episodes. But I'm going to take another break now, and when I get back, it's going to be Feedback City.
For you see, nothing ever happens on Mars. No sports or entertainment or strange than Mars. Supersonic airplanes, no sporty cars. The sun comes up, the sun goes down. You can't go to the country, you can't go to town. Boring, 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 boring.
That, of course, was Eugene Levy from Waiting for Guffman singing Nothing Ever Happens on Mars. Of course, when Waiting for Guffman came out, nothing did, but now we've got Curiosity Rover out there throwing donuts around the dust, so that has changed. Here's the first piece of feedback, and it's from our old friend Richard in Wichita.
Hey, this is Richard from Wichita, and I'm leaving some comments about the Martian Drive-In podcast. Your most recent episode, episode number 6, where you talked about Curse of the Undead and Shadow of the Vampire. Let me tell you, Curse of the Undead, we'll just talk real briefly about that for a second. I revisited that movie last year, went old school, watched it on VHS, because that movie has still not been released on DVD in the States, and I kind of doubt that it will. Maybe at some point they'll put it on one of those burn-on-demand discs, but other than that, I just don't see this one getting a set or certainly not getting an individual release. It's a quirky film, 1959, really at the tail end of the Universal horror days. I kind of like it for what it is. It is a little odd, but, you know, it's kind of a fun throwaway, 75 minutes long, throw it away, and, you know, after you got done watching it, it's not going to be a classic, but it's worth checking out and revisiting every once in a while. But the movie I really loved your discussion on was Shadow the Vampire. Now, this movie's been on my radar for a long time, and when I saw that you were going to be talking about it, I decided it was something I wanted to watch in October, which, of course, is when I watch a ton of horror movies. Well, then I decided to, this is where I enter my shameless plug for my own blog that I launched on October 1st. It's called monstermoviekid.wordpress.com. The main reason I launched this is because I wanted a way to just get my writing out there. I used to write in my youth and even had some stuff published on a very small level, very, very small level. But, you know, real life intervened, and for the last couple of years I've been trying to kind of rekindle that. Interestingly enough, I mean, I write for a living. I work for a global bank and I write internal communications, but as far as, you know, for fun writing, I've been trying to do it for the last couple of years. The problem is that I kind of get stuck in work mode, whereas I start writing and I constantly editing and changing what I'm writing, I keep going around in circles and I'm not getting anywhere. So this was a way for me to just write something and publish it and get it out and be done with it, rather than to sit there and constantly edit it and change it. And I've had a lot of fun with it. You know, I know you've checked out the site. It's just, you know, it's a throwaway, you know, two paragraphs or one really long paragraph on a movie. And for the month of October, I'm doing the 31 Days of Halloween. In November, I'll probably scale back to maybe two or three posts a week. But Shadow the Vampire was one of the movies that I chose to devote a day to. And then I decided, well, I'm just going to go full out and do a Nosferatu marathon. So I started with 1922's Nosferatu. Then I segued into 1979's remake with Klaus Kinski. Then I watched Nosferatu in Venice from 1988, and then I wrapped it up with Shadow the Vampire. Now, 1922 classic, there really isn't much to be said about this one, except do yourself a favor and try to find a good print of that. There's a lot of bad prints, unfortunately. I've got two bad prints. I don't have a good print, so it's this viewing made me decide I need to upgrade before I watch it again. I love the 1979 version with Klaus Kinski. I think it's one of the rare cases where a sequel, or rather a remake, far surpasses the original. Nosferatu in Venice. I'm going to go back to that in a second. But Shadow the Vampire, loved your discussion on it. For me, when I was watching this movie, and I loved the movie, it kind of reminded me of Hugo, which I think you've seen. It came out last year. You know, Hugo, in my mind, is an alternate universe version of the events around George Méliès. And I think that this is, in my mind, is an alternate universe version of Murnau and the filming of Nosferatu. John Malkovich was great. Willem Dafoe was just, he was awesomely over the top at times as Shrek. Really a fun film, and definitely something I can see myself going back to again. So your discussion on that just was kind of a great companion piece to it. Now, Nosferatu in Venice. Have you seen this thing? Do you even know about it? 1988 sequel of sorts to the 1979 version of Nosferatu. Klaus Kinski is back as the vampire. So many things about this movie, though. It went through four directors, and technically five, because reportedly Klaus Kinski even ended up directing himself in a couple of scenes. He shows up on set and says he's not shaving his head, he's not wearing the makeup, he'll wear the fangs briefly, he is going to sport his own look, which is actually at that point he showed up on set with long hair. That's how the vampire is going to look. It's not a bad film, it's just a little odd, because Kinski's performance, while at times he's very romantic in the lead role, but then other times he's very vicious. He plays the vampire very different than he did in 1979. And while I prefer the 1979 version of Nosferatu, I got to say the 1988 sequel, again, sequel of sorts, it's an interesting vampire flick. Good supporting cast, Christopher Plummer and Donald Pleasance. In retrospect, now that I'm thinking about it, I do think they're kind of underutilized in the film, but they're fun for what, you know, they offer. Not a bad flick. It's incredibly hard to find. It's never been released commercially here in the States. You don't find it on a lot of the torrents, and I've never found it on eBay. I found one person selling a copy on iOffer. It was an English dub with subtitles from some country. I don't even know where it's from. There is a copy of it on YouTube right now. Unfortunately, it's in Italian with no subtitles. However, that print really looks good. The print on my DVD was a little rough, actually a lot rough. But I don't know. Kind of curious if you've seen it, what your thoughts are on it. If not, check it out. I encourage you to. Just real quick, visited my folks down in Oklahoma, and as I always do, I listened to an episode of Paleo Cinema. It was the most recent episode where you're having just a discussion with Dr. Zalman, and I loved it. Kind of felt like a fly on the wall listening to two guys just rattle on about movies. Great discussion. Sir, I'm loving the shows as always. Keep up the good work. Take care. Happy Halloween, and we'll talk to you soon.
Thanks for that, Richard. I'll just mention the blog again. Your blog is monstermoviekid.wordpress.com, and it's in a very stylish black font, and it looks good. I've read through some of it, but not all of it, because life is like that sometimes. But I wish you all strength to it, and thank you again for your support of the podcast. It really does. I really look forward to your comments coming through on that one. Now, just let me have a look at something here. I just want to check something. So I was just going to check out Nosferatu in Venice, because I am intrigued. I think I might have seen it once. I've seen a lot of Klaus Kinski in the past, but I'm just going to see whether I can acquire a copy of it. And by acquire, I mean steal in a totally illicit manner. And I'm just waiting for that to come through. Yes, I can. I do have a copy of it. I've got a DVR copy, in fact, that I can acquire through subterranean means. It's a German bootleg DVD with English audio, so I'm going for that right now as we speak. So thanks for the heads up on that one. Klaus Kinski's a weird fucker in a lot of ways, including being a weird fucker, apparently. But, he's hypnotically weird in a lot of things. I like him in a lot of the old crimmy movies. He's been in a lot of crimmy movies in the early 1960s that I picked up. I think he's in one or two of the Dr. Mabuse ones. But I do know also he was in, I think, The Million Eyes of Sumeru and movies like that. So finding it, occasionally he does turn up unexpectedly in a Eurospy movie or two as well. So yeah, Klaus Kinski, definitely a weird bastard. Of course, Fitzcarraldo and all those sort of things, I won't even mention them because he's so so much of a force of nature in those films as well. But yeah, I think we should start a pantheon for Martian Drive-In podcast. And I definitely think Klaus Kinski is on there for being basically a weird bastard. You do need weird bastards. So there we go. The first one we've got is Klaus Kinski. Probably Michael Pate as well. Not only for being in Curse of the Undead, but for The Return of Captain Invincible, which I'm going to talk about in a future episode with Narelle. I do see your point, though, about Shadow of the Vampire being a kind of alternate universe version of things. And even though it's not explicitly stated, because a lot of people are scared of the word genre and of science fiction still, I definitely concede your point that it probably is an alternate universe version of Murnau's classic and the production thereof. But it's a great little weird film, beautiful. Well, I'm not even going to start talking about it again because I do like it a lot. I'm a little bit kind of wary of horror movies in Martian Drive-In podcast for a very obscure and weird reason. It's hard to find the obscure but the interesting that people don't already know about. It's not an easy ask. I do have a few Australian pieces that I might throw into the list. I do have a big list with IMDb links on it on a Word document that I give to people who are going to appear on episodes of Martian Drive-In and tell them to pick one of the two films we're going to do, and I'll pick the other one. And there are a few horror things on there. But it's a lot easier in science fiction for some reason to find those obscure gems than it is in horror because of just the how many people are out there doing horror podcasts, blogs, and other things, which isn't to say I'm going to stop trying. It's just that it's slightly more challenging things. The same thing with fantasy movies. I'm going to be doing some fantasy movies in Martian Drive in the future. But at this stage, finding the ones people don't necessarily know about is going to be the difficulty. I did also get a little bit of an unusual request from our friend Rickster. Now, he's putting together a little list, and I'll just read what he said. A request of my friends last year, Edgar Wright, who gave us Shaun of the Dead and Hot Fuzz, asked his friends to recommend to him movies he'd never seen. Of course, his friends included people like Quentin Tarantino and Joss Whedon. Edgar Wright's friends may have been more famous, but my friends have exquisite taste, so what do you say? As much of a movie nut as I am, there are a lot of movies that I've still not got around to seeing. So I'm asking everyone reading this, who is as much of a movie buff as I am, to give me a list of some of their favourite films. At least 10 or 15, but hey, give me 50 if you want. Sure, there's bound to be many I've already seen, but also bound to be a lot I haven't. In November, I'll try to rent the ones you recommend from your list and watch as many as I can, and I'll probably write them up on here on the or on my blog as well. So have a little fun and give me your list of some of my favourite films I should see. Okay, thanks in advance. I look forward to some quality viewing. Rickster, I'll tell you what I'll give you. I'll give you any Powell and Pressburger movie you've never seen, and there are a lot of them out there. That they did really 49th Parallel is fantastic if you haven't seen that. Just any of them. I Know Where I'm Going is really interesting as well. Let me see who else. Find some obscure Billy Wilder ones. There's one called A Foreign Affair with Marlene Dietrich that I'd recommend. As far as genre films are concerned, Creation of the Humanoids, if you haven't seen it. I talked about that in a very early paleo cinema, and I'm tempted to bring it into the Martian Drive-In and have a discussion with somebody else about it because I like it that much. It was one of Andy Warhol's favourite films and a really obscure, very small science fiction movie, which in spite of that is very interesting. Now, pretty much anything in paleo cinema or Martian Drive-In would be my answer to you on that, Rick. So go for the ones that you haven't seen. And I know that I've hipped you to a lot of movies that you then subsequently watch, but go back through the list of Paleo Cinema movies. There is a convenient little link in the top left-hand corner of both websites for you to go back. And there'll be things there that you didn't for some reason pick up on at the time, but you can find now, and I'd recommend those. But enjoy it. Anytime people have a project with movies, they never come out of it less than enthused about movies again and really passionate about increasing what they know and what they see in the cinema or in front of a screen of some kind. But that's about all I can recommend at the moment. For me, what I'm going to be doing now is counting down the sleeps until Skyfall comes out here in Australia. It's coming out a couple of weeks later than some other places, which totally pisses me off. But I'm there the first night, and I'm going to be watching it, and I'm going to have a great time doing so. But anyway, I'll be back with another Martian Drive-In podcast in 4 weeks, and I will have a guest. I've got a couple of people I'm going to hit up. There may be people who've already been on there. And if you want to be a guest on Martian Drive-In or Paleo Cinema, send me an email to cultguru@gmail.com, cult with a K. And the only thing I'd ask, and I'm sorry if this pisses off some people, and it isn't my intention, you've got to be able to talk well about stuff in to some extent. Now, enthusiasm is great, but you know, if you're going to get tongue-tied, it's going to be a little bit of a problem. But apart from that, if you know your stuff and you want to be a part of this, I'm more than happy to have guests on, particularly people that I haven't had guesting before, though. I will have a steady rotating cast of guests as well, because there are still things that I haven't talked about with Grant and Sonia I want to, and Narelle as well. I may even get Narelle's husband, Tim the Travel Writer, in as well if he's interested. But one way or the other, we're going to keep this going and keep it as much fun as it can possibly be. So that's about it. I'm going to love you and leave you now, and I'll be back in 2 weeks with another Paleo Cinema, and in 4 weeks with another Martian Drive-In. Look after yourselves. Hope everything's going well. Summer is coming in here, and I always find that my moods rise as the weather warms up. But anyway, I'll be back again in 2 weeks with Paleo Cinema over that side of things, and in 4 weeks with Martian Driving. Take care of yourselves and watch the skies.